The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You have a majority of investors today who are signing up for bonds as if there is no risk, signing up for stocks as if it is a one-way bet, signing up for Bitcoin as if 20% volatility is no big deal because you know you're going to have 40% upside tomorrow. Maybe, but maybe not. So, I mean, my advice, step aside, hedge your bets. That's it.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, again, you're remote, but this time we can say that the conferences, the ones we did this summer and the ones we did this late fall, are now over. Now, you're still not back in the office. I was joking with you a little while ago. I said, maybe what we need to do is come up with a coffee table book that shows where you do the show from different venues. I mean, you've done them in Switzerland. You've done them in airport bathrooms. You're in a laundry room right now because they're doing construction next door there in Florida.
Yeah, Kevin, 15 minutes ago, I was in the surf, got about 3/4 of a mile swim in. We're in the Florida Panhandle, if anyone knows where Destin is. And I'm meeting with some family for a day or two just to brainstorm a variety of things. So yeah, I got a good swim in just before the commentary, and now I'm in a laundry room because it is the only quiet spot next to construction adjacent. So if you do hear any jackhammers in the background, that's what it is. But I've turned the laundry, the washer and dryer completely off.
Dave, I remember interviewing your dad earlier this year while he was in the Philippines there at the orphanage. And there was this guy who was mowing the lawn right outside the open window. You know, your dad, he gets so focused, he didn't even know it was happening. But about every 3 minutes, I would hear this loud roar go by him. Yeah. Made for a good recording. It just proved to me that Don is focused on the things that are important. You being in a laundry room are focused as well. You know, while you were swimming, I hate to say this, Dave, but here we go again. $1.5 billion worth of gold futures, naked futures, were dumped on the market to push gold below the 200-day moving average. You know, this is amazing. We've talked over the last couple of weeks how 3 weeks ago it was $4 billion worth of gold dumped instantly to knock the market down, and then it rose again, and then $2 billion worth of gold, and then it rose again. You know, that $1.5 billion this week dumped on the market instantly to try to push it down. You know, I think we probably, instead of focusing on gold going down with these futures manipulations, we probably ought to look at who the heck is buying the physical gold every time it drops.
Well, you're right, Kevin. I think one of the things that it reminds me of, you and I have had a conversation about an old book called Magic and Showmanship, and in it, it talks about the art of redirection. And so much of what we see today in the markets is just that, the art of redirection. And, you know, there's so many things that are happening in the sovereign bond market that are of substance that, you know, what happens in the gold market, certainly there is this design and desire on the part of the powers that be to say, look, not only is it good, but it's getting better. We're moving towards our perfect economic and financial utopia. All you have to do is trust us and everything will be just fine. And a part of that is hammering the gold price periodically. We saw Paul Volcker, this is not speculation on our part, from his memoirs, he said his one mistake in the 1970s wasn't destroying the price of gold as an indicator of concern in the marketplace. And that's really what it is. It's a barometer of things that aren't quite right. And the fact that there is massive physical demand all throughout Asia, and that keeps on buoying the price, you are running into this conflict between the paper world, which gets sold off periodically, short-term manipulation, today's a case in point, and the longer-term trend where real supply and demand are in play, and demand in Asia is taking the available supply simply off the market.
Yeah, China's actually been buying all the gold that's mined in the world, and they're not selling any of theirs. They're the number one miner, as you know, in the world. They don't sell any of their gold. They keep it, and then they still turn around and buy just about as much off the market. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, Dave. You know, it's about time for us to have a guest. You know, the stock market, of course, is hitting all-time highs. We've got Bitcoin hitting all-time highs and wiggling around. We've got this mania that seems to be going on in the markets. And one of my favorite authors, as far as the chart charts that he produces and the evidence that he shows of, you know, historic highs always turn into a consequence later, is a guy named Alan Newman. I'm wondering if we ought not to have Alan Newman on the show maybe in the next week or so to bring to light just where we are in historic terms with these markets.
Well, and I think the importance there is that, you know, in the last 4 years, we've had a number of guys who've been writers and commentators in the marketplace pass away. Alan Abelson was a regular guest on our commentary. Cy Harding, Joe Granville, Richard Russell, Marty Zweig. You've got a number of people who, you know, spent 40, 50 years in the markets commenting and bringing insight. And what you have with Newman is the same. He's been writing 53 years as an editor of Cross Currents. And to get some perspective on where we're at and where we're going, I think we do a reasonable job on the commentary. But frankly, to bring in someone who's seasoned by an additional 25, 30 years of market experience, I think it's very important to have some winsome thoughts from someone who's been there and done that.
Well, so I would recommend for the listeners who can tune in next week, definitely listen to the Alan Newman comments. Now, it's sort of sad, Dave, thinking about some of the great minds that we've had on this show that since we've been doing this for a decade now, have passed away. You know, sometimes the greatest lessons come from the oldest people. I hate to say this. In fact, it reminds me sort of John Maynard Keynes' quote. You know, he said, in the long run, we're all dead. You know, that's a truth. And what we're running on right now is all borrowed money. And, you know, I'm not a fan, and I know you're not a huge fan of John Maynard Keynes' solutions, but he had some pretty witty ways of saying things. And there's a quote that he came out with that talks about foreign loans, because we've been just living on borrowed money. And here's his quote. It says, foreign loans enable a country to live beyond its resources for a considerable time at the risk of ultimate default. Dave, the only thing we're missing at this point, we've been living on foreign loans, we've been living on loans to ourselves. The only thing we're really missing is the defaults. Like the lady said in the Wendy's commercial, where's the beef? Where are the defaults? We don't have them anymore.
Yeah, Carmen Reinhart has written another great paper on sovereign defaults. The title is Capital Flow Cycles, A Long Global View. And I found it intriguing that her cohort of academic contributors, her husband Vincent Reinhart and Christoph Trebesch, I can't help but think of Alex Trebek every time I see his name, but they're all curious as to the unexpected outcomes here in the post-2011 to present period. You're looking at right. The emerging market debt crises going back to the first big one in 1827, they look at the pattern of credit booms and busts where there's a meaningful number of defaults that typically follow in the bust period. And they point to this 1999 to 2011 boom in the emerging markets and in the commodity sectors. And they say, this is kind of the odd man out. There should be at least 15 to 20 significant sovereign defaults following the run-up in commodity prices and the increase in hot money flows into the emerging markets in that time frame, actually following that time frame, so sort of 2011 to the present.
So that's a natural consequence of these credit booms and busts, is there's a certain amount of defaults that you would just expect to occur.
Yep, they're not there. Or should we say that differently? They are not there yet. Word placement is amazing, isn't it? Was it the extraordinary central bank intervention which prevented these 15 to 20 cases of sovereign default from ever happening? Or as the paper asks, is it merely postponed it for the duration of those policies which remain in place? So, I mean, personally for me, coming from sort of a Minskian or Austrian perspective, the current stability is very suspicious.
Well, as you remember, Dave, last, I think it was September 2016, there was a very illuminating interview that you did with Carmen Reinhart, the co-author of this paper. And, you know, that interview she brought out, what made it illuminating was the one of the ways that they've been able to avoid default on these debts is by trying to close up the system. And she says, ultimately, we'll have to create a captive audience to keep things held together. Now, she co-authored a book back in 2009 with Ken Rogoff, who's a very strong proponent of getting rid of cash in the system. And now she's co-authored this paper with her husband and Trebesch saying, where are the defaults and will they ever come?
Well, the conversation between the co-authors is a fascinating one, because in these cycles of default, Reinhardt and that crew, they point to the inflationary disruptions that usually follow on the heels of sovereign defaults. And, you know, we pointed this out a couple of years ago, Kevin. I think it was Lex Riefel, if my memory serves me correctly, pointed out that there's a much higher correlation in the 20th century between credit problems and currency crises that follow than in the 19th century. It used to be that when you had credit problems, it impacted banks and the financial sector players primarily, so that a credit crisis and a banking crisis were linked. But something changed, because in the 20th century, with the popularization of fiat currency, you could almost say the democratization of credit, what we've also come up with is the democratization of crisis. Now, every man, woman, and child gets to stand between the credit and banking sector dominoes as they fall. And they get to see and enjoy the consequences of default as they get played out in a devalued currency. So, you know, what under the gold standard was fairly limited in terms of the impact on individual lives, because it was cordoned off within the banking sector, now you see some follow through between the credit market problems and ultimately currency crisis. So again, whether it's what's Reinhardt in this paper or Riefel from years ago, looking at sovereign defaults and restructuring of loans and things, it's just interesting that we're not seeing the defaults.
Well, and didn't we see this from 2008 on? Okay, so it was the bankers that largely gained the reward of the credit boom that came up to the credit bust, yet the consequences are being spread to the innocent, those who didn't have any of the gain from the risk that was being taken that they're paying for at this point. You know, it's almost like consolidate the gains to the few and spread the risk to the innocent and the many. That's amazing. It's criminal.
You know, privatized gains, socialized pain. So, I mean, the paper explores the capital flow bonanza, as they put it, that capital flow bonanza between 1999 and 2011. And the big question is, why is this period different than other historical antecedents? So again, massive capital flows, 1999 to 2011. And if you're looking back in time, there have been 14 major booms just like this period. 11 of those were followed by a rash of sovereign defaults. 6 of the default periods were on a massive global scale, and 4 of those 6 included a double bust of both capital and commodity markets. So, I mean, very common in nearly all the cases was a surge in capital flows, and then the economic crisis that came afterwards, where, you know, again, as the dust began to settle, you had inflation and currency problems as a result as well. So where are the defaults?
Yeah, well, it takes me back to 2011. September of 2011, gold was peaking at $1,900 an ounce, and it looked like it was going to go higher because the crisis was actually playing itself out still from 2008. And then Mario Draghi came out, you know, the head of the European Central Bank, and he said, "We're going to do whatever it takes." Well, those words, who would have thought that here we are in 2017, the end of 2017, those words are continuing to play out as we speak. Of course, gold peaked out in 2011. It came down and really didn't bottom out until December of 2015. Now, it's been rising since then, but we still see this do whatever it takes out of all the central banking community. It doesn't seem to have an end.
Draghi's comments came in June and July, and then you had the subsequent European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, and Fed balance sheet commitments, where they bought tons and tons of assets and just absorbed them onto their balance sheet. And so maybe that is sufficient to eliminate defaults from the cycle. But the reality is, it was normal in the 2012 to 15 period to expect a number of sovereign defaults, because that's what happens in history. That's what happens as a consequence of these massive capital flows, right? But it didn't happen. And so figuring out why is very important. This is significant because the findings in the study return us to some very basic concerns that we had in 2011 and have reconfirmed them as valid. You've got the credit boom both prior to 08 and 09 and the subsequent credit expansions in its wake, where the central banks have increased their balance sheet, you know, cumulatively $10 trillion between your major world central banks. And everything we know from history and the way that market dynamics have worked in the past is that that should, with very high probabilities, lead to a series of sovereign defaults with economic ramifications as well as the normal pattern of currency devaluation commonly associated with a sovereign crisis. So here I am, blue in the face from holding my breath from then to now.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always a consequence. One of the things in human life that can actually get us into trouble over and over and over, and hopefully we start learning our lessons as we get older. But when you're young, you do an awful lot of things thinking, well, I can get away with it. There's really probably not going to be a consequence. As you get older, you start to realize there are always consequences. So as we look at this and say, all right, where are the defaults? Well, there will be a price to be paid. Now, maybe default looks a little bit different, but Dave, are we seeing any consequences currently?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I listened to one of the Dallas Fed folks, Kaplan, who says, you know, this last week, we now have gone 12 months without a 3% correction in the U.S. stock market. This is extraordinarily unusual, he says. And I just think, you know, whether we're talking about defaults or the current behavior in the stock market, those words, extraordinarily unusual, suggest that either something has radically shifted and we're dealing with a brand new set of variables, or we're just playing with time. So, I mean, again, I'm searching for an explanation. Perhaps it is that the central banks did enough. Perhaps it is, you know, this is one of the unique aspects of that boom period. You go back to the boom period and you had a massive increase in commodity prices. Again, right. You go back to 99 to 2011. In real commodity price terms, this is non-oil, you had increases in percentage terms, which were unbelievable. They increased in percentage terms more than they did back in the 1938 to 1951 period, which had been the highest price increase in this century. And it even exceeded, if you go back a long time, it exceeded the commodity price bonanza of the late, you know, 1792 to 1801. So we asked this question, is it possible that sovereign defaults were averted due to the massive increase in reserves that countries were building from the export of those commodities? Yeah, because normally the commodity boom bust cycle is an overlay for the credit boom and bust cycle. You know, so there's a possible explanation here. Maybe they just reaped the reward of a huge commodity price increase and therefore had enough reserves, had enough cushion to avoid a significant drawdown. So that's a possible explanation. I looked through the paper carefully, and in one of the tables on page 21, titled Capital Flow Surges, Declines, and Sudden Stops, you can see that as a percentage of GDP, the change between 1999 and 2011, that's a 12-year period, nearly matched the period from 1918 to 1929, both in duration and in terms of percentage change. Again, we're talking about a credit boom. 18.4% growth in the earlier period, 18.3% growth in this most recent period. The 2011 to 2016 period, getting us to the current day almost, we have seen a decline in capital flows by 23.7% as a percent of GDP, which is nearly twice the average. Still not as great as what happened during the Great Depression, 1929 to 1933. So again, we've had a massive increase in capital flows and credit, and then a massive decrease, 23.5% as a percentage of GDP. And yet, sovereign defaults are virtually non-existent. 15 to 20 would be normal. That would be the norm.
Well, and that's incredible, because what we're talking about, anytime you have a massive boom, okay, 1918 to 1929, of course, we all know what happened in 1929. We went into a long depression, the longest that we'd had in the century. And then that's the bust. You have defaults during that time. And then from 1999 to 2011, okay, of course, that was another boom period. And then we had our bust, but we really haven't had the bust. Now, you know, we've talked about this before. There's a name for this, Dave. When the central banks come in and create an environment where there are no defaults, where they hide that there's actually a consequence to actions, that's called moral hazard, because you don't just stop there. You're not just papering over mistakes or sins of the past. What you're doing is you're creating sins for the future.
Well, I mean, back to that critical issue. If you've got central bank intervention that can prevent defaults, is it only for the intervening period where central bank activism remains in place. Yeah. I mean, to get to the chase, does normalization of interest rates, because that's what we're talking about right now. We're talking about central banks normalizing rates. And if we see normalization of interest rates and reconstruction of central bank balance sheets, because that's what everyone in the central bank community is talking about doing now and in 2018, going back to the pre-crisis formats for both of those, does that trigger a return to the normal pressures that debtors feel under the strain of high debt levels and less than adequate, even potentially declining revenues? This is the key. We've, in essence, covered over a problem. And if you take away the props, what happens? I think Reinhardt's asking a serious question. I mean, I'll put it in the most approachable language I can. Do the wheels come off in the sovereign bond market, as they typically do, when central banks step back from their current commitments? The obvious ramifications are directly into the countries affected by default. You've got a variety of emerging market players which would be impacted. But also, you've got the investors who need to be aware of their exposure to those emerging markets as well. And then one third category is that you've got implications into the global economy. An emerging market crisis based on defaults is not limited to the emerging markets. We have a very interconnected global economy. We all would surely feel the pain of the linkages and the pressures that creates.
Well, and don't you think that's maybe why, in reality, they can't normalize rates? You know, I think of the song, I'm wondering if it's too late, we're too far into this, you know, like Richard Duncan talks about. He's like, hey, don't stop now, you know. And so I hate to sing to you, Dave, but, you know, it's too late to turn back now. I believe in the central banks. You know, I'm wondering if that's the song at this point, if, you know, it's just too late to turn back at this point. What's the consequence worldwide, not just in the United States, but you're talking about the emerging markets now?
You know, so basically what we've had happen is investors have said, if I can't find a good value here in the United States, things are getting pricey in the U.S. stock market, maybe I'll go and look in the emerging markets. So investors, you know, may be tempted to look on a comparative basis at the emerging markets as a better value than the developed world markets today, certainly the U.S. And if you're looking at valuation metrics alone, you are correct. The emerging markets are selling at prices which are considerably below the U.S. markets. But is cheaper cheap enough? Or can it get even cheaper still? I think the answer to that is always. It can always get cheaper. The issue in play is really whether or not the emerging markets can escape entirely from what Reinhardt describes as that capital inflow default cycle, or whether that pain sort of at the economic periphery in these emerging markets is actually closer than we think today, with very significant implications for the economic core as well.
Well, Dave, if we're going to give praise to the central banks and say, all right, well, good, lowering interest rates really did work, printing money, quantitative easing really worked, isn't it a contradiction to say that when we reverse those things, they won't have any other consequence to the other direction? I mean, in a way, you're nullifying the causal effect of what the central banks are claiming success at. If they can turn around and say, no, if we raise rates and we stop quantitative easing, it'll really not do anything to the system.
Yeah, there's no doubt that what we experienced 2008 and 2009 was triage, the equivalent of medical triage, with the banking sector and the financial markets hemorrhaging and tourniquets necessary, cauterizing of wounds necessary, extreme interventionist measures necessary. And the big question is, you know, has the patient fully recovered? Is the patient capable of getting up on his or her own and moving on? I'm fascinated by this. You know, on the one hand, we have what Reinhardt talks about, you know, the capital flow boom and bust. How she describes it is you've had declines in interest rates at the center, which act as a push factor to capital inflows, and rate hikes often contribute to an abrupt reversal. That's her conclusion. So yes, she agrees with you. When you start to hike rates and normalize, you lower rates to accommodate, and that is your version or one of the many versions of market triage. But then, yeah, you put rates higher, and that can contribute to an abrupt reversal, which may be, in fact, a sufficient trigger for those 15 to 20 missing defaults. On the other hand, I mean, so that's one thing. We may just in the process of normalizing get our 15 to 20 defaults, sovereign defaults, and that could be a 2018, 2019 event unfolding as we quote unquote normalize. On the other hand, think about this a little differently instead of just kind of going back to normal, because these guys believe their own BS at this point. Everything's healthy. Right. Everything's fine. We're going ahead because we know the patient is just fine. But what if, on the other hand, we had a single party actor lash out and change the rules of market engagement, triggering a panic?
Dave, you know what that reminds me of? Okay, in the 1990s, it always cracks me up when I have to get a map or a globe out to figure out somebody who actually triggered a worldwide crisis, okay? I mean, maybe some people know where Malaysia is, but not everybody. And, you know, you go back to the Asian crisis, and I remember I had to go get a globe when the Asian crisis occurred, because it's like, wait a second, Malaysia? Really? Malaysia? They triggered billions and billions of dollars worth of loss? Where's Malaysia?
Yeah, well, and this was back in September of 1998. And you had Mahathir Mohamad. He's now the former prime minister of Malaysia. And he was a single party actor in the Asian crisis who did this. Now, fast forward, Turkey may be just the actor today. You've got capital controls. They have huge consequences. That's what we saw happen in 1998, declaring capital controls September 1st, 1998. And literally all hell broke loose and the Asian contagion was off and running. Certainly exaggerated by that. One of those implications of capital controls is that it causes a broad rethink on capital accessibility. So when controls are raised in one geography, whether it's Malaysia or Turkey, it has a sobering effect amongst investors all over the globe who might have forgotten that getting their money back from a certain region of the world is not always guaranteed. So when you've got capital controls put in place, there are those directly impacted, and then there are the investors indirectly impacted with allocations in every other fund imaginable who ask, if it could happen to them, could it happen to me?
Well, Dave, there's nothing more frustrating than going to an institution like a bank or, in this case, a country, and saying, I'd like my money back, please. And they say, well, no, you can't have it. What an incredibly helpless feeling. If you've ever been told you can't have your money, what it does is it creates panic. And that panic becomes contagious. That's what a bank run is.
Well, and I think what's easy to forget when we see prices and technology and complexity all playing in together, really the markets are one thing. The markets are psychology. And psychology in the market is contagious. You know, and that can be positive momentum or negative momentum. But this is why and how momentum becomes so powerful, both on the upside swing and on the downside as prices decline. You can go from normal times to abnormal in a matter of seconds. Those bank run dynamics of the 1930s, probably the best paper I ever read on that was a classic 1983 paper titled Bank Runs, Deposit Insurance, and Liquidity. And it was co-authored by two people, Diamond and Dibvig. What they consider at the bank level is just as true in terms of international capital flows and those run dynamics. When a bank says you can't have your money, when any institution says you can't have your money, what they call suspending convertibility, where you temporarily are not able to access your assets, it's comparable to a country implementing capital controls. And what you end up having is individual investors or actors, if you will, rationally determining that the game has changed. And you know what they try to do? They try to change their allocations. They try to grab as much of their money as they can. It's like a bank run. And in mass, it looks like an irrational panic when at an individual level, it's just an individual saying, if I don't get my money now, I might not get it at all. And we're getting awfully close to that dynamic in Turkey.
You know, Dave, we were talking the other night about the movie Dr. Strangelove. And of course, Dr. Strangelove is a sort of a comedy parody of the mindset of the two rational actors in nuclear war back in, it was made in the early 60s. And we've talked about mutually assured destruction actually being sort of a form of game theory. As long as you have two rational actors, you can actually say, all right, This is a gentleman's agreement between the two of us. I've got a lot of nuclear weapons. You've got a lot of nuclear weapons. As long as neither one of us uses them, we're all going to live in peace. Now, in a strange way, we've created a form of mutually assured destruction with this debt system. Everyone's gone into huge debt, but really the agreement between rational actors, as long as we have rational actors, is as long as you don't call in your debts, I won't call in mine. Now, you have an Erdogan. Okay, rational actors, the reason mutually assured destruction doesn't work anymore is because you've got North Korea with nukes. You've got Iran possibly with nukes. That whole rational actor agreement thing with nukes doesn't work anymore. I'm wondering if Erdogan will be the guy who's no longer the rational actor, no longer the gentleman's agreement guy that actually pulls the plug.
Yeah, and I mean, to be generous on this, maybe he's entirely rational and he's just working with bad economic assumptions, in which case he comes to what appears to be irrational conclusions, when in fact they are to him and to his counselors entirely rational. They're just working with bad assumptions. He sees the increases in interest rates, which are now above 12%. That's objectionable. And he's close to reacting in ways that you typically see authoritarians act. You've got rates in that country, which are rising. You've got the lira, their currency, which is falling, and he's on the verge of lashing out. You've got our friend Russell Napier, who points out that it is the perfect environment for capital controls. And Erdogan is the man for the job.
So what are the consequences of that?
Well, it may be the trigger which recalibrates investor thinking on emerging markets. Again, why is that important? Because here we are wondering where the defaults went. And the defaults may be waiting in the wings. And it may be because we normalize and come back to balance sheet normalcy in the developed world. Or it may be that from the emerging markets, we have something that represents a singular trigger and initiates the missing default cycle. It comes down to this. Will we see a string of sovereign defaults due to the central bank gravity fighting, all the measures that we've seen post-2008 and 2009, and a blanket promise that Draghi gave us in 2011, June of 2011, will we see that shelved, and will gravity now begin to have its impact on the market? Or will we see a string of sovereign defaults due to a recalibration of investor thinking akin to a run on the bank? As you have new data, something like capital controls, that's a new information feed, which introduces a new perspective on risk in the current environment. Or maybe there's just no sovereign defaults at all. We'll have to see.
Well, and that's what we were talking about. I mean, is it too late to turn back, and will central banks do anything they possibly can? But, you know, this whole central bank cartel still seems to be somewhat of a Western world phenomenon. You know, we now have China in the mix, and we know that they're doing things that are looking more independent every day. I mean, how about China trade relations and some of these things? Again, mutually assured destruction only works when you have a couple of players all in agreement. When they start coming out of agreement, whether it's an Erdogan or whether it's just natural forces that come from China emerging as a new world economic superpower, that could also trigger it, couldn't it?
Yeah, because I mean, we're really talking about a terms of trade crisis. And so when you look at the trade relations that China has with so many of the emerging market commodity producers, it's difficult to imagine that tightening credit, whether it is in Asia, let's say China is able to wrap its arms around the wealth management products and start to get control of the shadow banking system, whether it's tightening of credit in Asia, China specifically, or in America or Europe. I mean, the question is, doesn't that lift the carpet a bit and kind of show you what was swept under it 4 or 5 years ago? Do we know the trigger? No. We do not know the trigger, but can we see issues which serve as a backdrop for financial market instability? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Dave, wasn't it William McChesney Martin, head of the Federal Reserve back in the 50s? Isn't he the one who said you can put the punch bowl out, but you want to remove the punch bowl before the party really gets started? Something like that. I mean, the central banks right now, let's just use the Federal Reserve as our central theme here as I ask this question. The Federal Reserve has got to be watching what's going on Wall Street right now and almost the euphoria that's being played out. You know, most of it is corporate share buybacks, but what it's really doing is it's pushing the market into new territory, higher highs. We've got higher margin debt than we've ever had. At some point, they're going to have to start considering removing the punch bowl.
Right. So the recently retired head of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, said something to the effect of, this is just in recent weeks, you should not underestimate the danger of being too slow in normalizing rates and normalizing central bank balance sheets. I don't disagree with that, Kevin. I don't disagree with that. But it's, in our opinion, there's a real conundrum here because the need to normalize is already past due. Yet the financial system frailties may in fact be revealed by that very thing. Normalization, again, kind of going back to the patient analogy, having assumed the patient no longer needed life support, wouldn't it be tragic to discover the acute underlying needs only after you've taken the respirators off and the IVs are disconnected and been pulled away? And this takes us back to Reinhardt's suggestion. Have we only delayed the default cycle?
Well, not only delayed it, Dave, but when you delay something like this, you only make it bigger. So if the default comes, this will probably be much larger than what it ever would have been had it played out naturally.
Well, but here's one other thing that makes it interesting, Kevin. You say bigger. The big shift, the past debt crises that we saw were tied to bank lending. And this may be a subtle difference to those of you who are not financial market practitioners, but past debt crises were tied to bank lending, and you had panic dynamics, which exacerbated an exit from the asset classes. And, you know, that was a particular geographic region, and it led to a unique currency chaos dynamic. The transformation in recent years has been borrowers tapping the bond market rather than traditional bank lending, which has provided for not only exceptionally affordable loans and generous terms, but it's also created a world in which people feel as if they have lots of liquidity with those assets. So here's some things to look for. It's not clear what happens when a mass of investors want out of the bond market. I mean, liquidity is assumed, but it's not guaranteed.
If they're treating bonds like banks, they're assuming there's an FDIC standing behind them that will always provide liquidity. But the bond market doesn't have an FDIC, do they?
Well, it's not just an FDIC or an implicit guarantee. It's that there's really not as much of a, I don't want to say there's not much of a two-way market. There is a two-way market in the bond world, obviously, but there is no, just like in the past couple of months, we've talked about a gutting of the incentives for Wall Street market makers to inventory shares of companies. And we really don't know what the liquidity dynamics are in the next downturn with all the ETFs that have traded and the popularization of ETFs and the elimination of market makers. The same thing's happened in the bond market, where there's not as many people who are willing to step up and buy the asset class. There's been an expansion of debt, not just in banks, but specifically in the bond market. And there's implied liquidity in the bond market. And again, I'll say it again, liquidity is assumed, but it is not guaranteed. I think the next emerging market debacle may in fact test the idea of bonds being a liquid asset class. And then we come full circle. We've got central banks trying to extricate themselves and normalize. But that cycle, a non-virtuous cycle of illiquidity in the bond market, as it's revealed, it may require a buyer of last resort, arguing for another round of central bank balance sheet expansion. So what takes the Fed's balance sheet from, you know, four, almost 5 trillion to 10 trillion? Maybe it's a reduction by 500 billion on its way to 10 trillion, as that creates problems in the bond market, which they then have to step in and fix.
Something you've talked about many times, Dave, and this is so important to keep in mind, when risk is not accurately priced, you know, when you've got a buyer of last resort always coming in and infusing that IV, you know, you talked about being on life support. Well, life support has a consequence also to the market. If the central banks are the buyer of last resort of all the debt, what it does is it reprices the risk, the interest rate that's being paid. And in a way, we're seeing very, very high risk investments, things that are probably going to default, priced as if they have no risk whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you get in a price anymore? When I see Turkish bonds yielding 12%, that should tell you that there's greater risk there, right? And yet, you look at a 12% rate of return there, factor out local inflation in the lira, and compare that to the US dollar, and local inflation in dollar terms. And this is somewhat ironic. The investor in U.S. 10-year treasuries is compensated in real terms almost identically with the investor in Turkish bonds. Again, take out the inflation penalty, and your Turkish and U.S. bond investors are getting in the neighborhood of 30 basis points apiece. What's the difference? The whole world has been homogenized. And whether you think the prices are relevant or not, the whole world is being homogenized. That was the point with the conversation of Carmen Reinhart 6-12 months ago. And I would say that in both cases, the Turkish and U.S. investor, these are investors that are not adequately compensated for the risks that they're taking, whether it's inflation risks. I think we have a high likelihood of an inflationary surprise in the United States. They already have inflation in Turkey. But so in real terms, they're on a par with each other. That's kind of an interesting deal. Are they being adequately compensated for the risks that they're taking? I just feel like that's an easy no.
Well, and in a way, we feel used and abused, okay, because we see not only buyers of last resort, these central banks printing money coming in and just, like you said, socializing all the prices. The risk has been completely masked by the amount of interest that it's paying. And sometimes it's easy to just get angry, you know, with the manipulations and this control force that's in the world. But actually, we can only control ourselves. We can only control what we do. So, Dave, so that we don't leave the podcast feeling helpless and hopeless, what are things that the individual can do right now so that they're not participating in something that maybe they clearly see and don't want to participate in?
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to sum it up in simple terms, my advice, step aside and hedge your bets. You've got Saunders, who's one of the key players at Charles Schwab, and she says, you know, I think it's finally starting to suck people in emotionally. She's talking about the stock market. It's finally beginning to suck people in emotionally, and actually it's hard to judge why now, all of a sudden, but maybe it's because of how persistent the move has been with so little volatility on the upside and on the downside. This year has been different. This kind of year pulls people in. And that just says to me, hedge your bets, step aside. When everyone and their brother is being sucked into the market, everyone and their brother is ignoring risk in the bond market and in the stock market. This is one of those clear signs. Just count the burgeoning mass of people and what they're doing and try to take the other side of the trade. Try to move the other direction. Try to think a little bit differently, because when everyone is moving one direction, this goes back to something my dad said in our last presentation to clients. Majority is always wrong. Majority is always wrong. And you have a majority of investors today who are signing up for bonds as if there is no risk, signing up for stocks as if it is a one-way bet, signing up for Bitcoin as if 20% volatility is no big deal because you know you're going to have 40% upside tomorrow. Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe not. So, I mean, my advice, step aside, hedge your bets. That's it.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Join us next week when we have guest Alan Newman on the program. You can call us at 800-525-9556 or visit our website at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.